Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the Trump-Russia story that continues to haunt a president who vents into the wee hours of the morning, calling his friends who wake up to a diatribe of complaints from the beleaguered leader of the free world. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss the latest twists and turns in a story that won't go away, although now that the Washington Post has released an exhaustive investigative article, Obama's secret struggle to punish Russia for Putin's election assault, Trump is now blaming the whole Russian election meddling saga on Obama. We will look into the irony that now at least Trump is acknowledging that he is acknowledging what he has long denied, that the Russian meddling took place, and the reasons why the White House is lawyering up with both Trump and Pence hiring defense lawyers, and whether General Flynn is cooperating with the FBI and spilling the beans on who colluded with the Russians, and in terms of a cover-up, what did they know and when did they know it? Then we'll look further into the intelligence angle on perhaps the most extraordinary revelation in the Washington Post article that Putin personally ordered the U.S. election active measures operation and oversaw it, evidence apparently obtained by U.S. intelligence from inside Putin's inner circle. Malcolm Nance, a globally recognized counterintelligence expert and intelligence community member, joins us. He is the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. And we will discuss where the various investigations are heading. Then finally, we'll assess the frenzied rumors and rampant speculation that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy is about to retire, and speak first with Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, who frequently argues before the Supreme Court. Then Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State College of Law, joins us to analyze the impact on the country of a shift to the hard right, with Trump appointing another arch-conservative to the Supreme Court, given that Trump's new lawyer, Jay Sekulow, is the former lawyer for the anti-abortion evangelists Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And this, as I mentioned in the opening, Scott, this story simply won't go away, although obviously Donald Trump wishes it would, and apparently it's really driving him crazy. He sort of wanders around the White House in the wee hours of the morning like some character out of King Lear, ranting on the phone to his friends about how beleaguered and unfair it all is. And it's apparently some of his closest friends are worried about his health, not to mention his mental state of mind.
Television.
Pardon?
Speaking to the television, too, we're told.
Right. I can just imagine what that dialogue is about. What do you make of this? Obviously, there's too many people on the Democratic side in this country who are so invested in an impeachment or even in some kind of meltdown that they may be disappointed. But on the other hand, it does seem like this guy is really, he can't get out from under it. And why do you think he can't get out from under it?
Well, if you know, there are two ways of explaining it. One is just sheer distraction. That is, you know, it bothers him. He focuses on it, even though it isn't something terribly important. And he has a silver bullet response to every accusation. That strikes me as less likely. The more likely is that he knows much more than anyone else what Donald Trump's role was in this entire affair. And he's very, very worried about details of it coming out. He's worried about it being potentially incriminating. And so I think, you know, we have Washington is, as it usually does, mostly focused on the cover-up and the procedural side of the story. But, you know, we should keep our eye actually on the substantive side. And there, you know, we've seen quite a bit more detail about how this evolved, and now we're moving towards a much better resourced FBI investigation of the entire matter under the leadership of one of the best special prosecutors imaginable, Robert Mueller.
So what do you make then of this extraordinary? I mean, one shouldn't be so surprised by the twists and turns and by the incredible inconsistencies of Donald Trump, but it's amusing in a way that he's now, and certainly predictable, that he's now blaming the entire Russia situation on Obama, because, you know, since the Washington Post broke that very, very well, thoroughly documented and extremely interesting long piece that they did a couple of days ago, Trump is now blaming Obama for everything. But in doing so, he's acknowledging for the first time, since he's denied it from day one, that the Russian election attack actually took place. So I guess we should be thankful for small mercies.
Yes, he may admit and then deny again. Of course, it's also been something that's been typical of his conduct over the last couple of years. But if you look back at the election campaign in 2016 and even before that, one thing that was absolutely a constant was blame Obama. It was blame Obama for anything that went wrong. It was always Barack Obama's fault. So it seems actually natural for Trump to be blaming Obama for the Russian hacking. But, you know, that being said, I think anyone who has read the expose, it's actually not an expose, it's more a chronicling, a very detailed chronicle, even a sort of book about how this scandal arose within the administration, how it learned about it, and how it handled it. I mean, certainly the definitive account to date. And I don't think anybody can read that without questioning, and questioning rather sharply, the way Barack Obama handled it. You know, it's clear that he was driven by a desire for civil dialogue with the Republican leadership, for deference with the Republican leadership, wanting to bring them in, wanting to be sure that anything that was said rested on a bipartisan consensus and had their support. But, of course, they denied that effectively. And the result in the end of the day is instead of having disclosures of what the government knew in real time in the course of the election, all we had was this written statement that came out in October, pretty much on the eve of election, before there was an opportunity for it really to soak in. That is, Barack Obama allowed the Republican leadership's obstruction to stand in the way of the public learning about what was going on.
Congressman Schiff, a Democrat, minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee, he's likening Donald Trump's complaints, now accusing Obama and holding him responsible for the White House inaction to deal with the Russian active measures campaign. Quoting Congressman Schiff about Trump, knowingly receiving stolen property and blaming police for not stopping the theft. That is what he's accusing Trump of essentially behaving like. And it's true. It is pretty extraordinary, isn't it, that, Trump was the beneficiary of the stolen property. It's very likely that he was getting real-time intelligence from the Russians. I mean, if they had taken the trouble to hack into the DNC and to hack into the Hillary Clinton's campaign manager's email, they wouldn't have sat on that information, I don't think. They later, of course, dumped it on WikiLeaks at a very strategic moment. But it is very much like Trump's having received stolen property, and then he's blaming the police for not stopping the theft.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I would say technically it would be hard to make out that case as a matter of law, but it seems to me morally it's similar. And we have another thing, of course, that is at one of his campaign rallies, he actively solicited the hacking of his opponent, saying it would be a good thing if they did it, and hoping that they did. I mean, that's actually an extraordinary thing too. And one has to wonder, you know, when you see these statements, they suggest foreknowledge of what the Russians were actively doing, which is striking to me too.
Well, when you mentioned earlier the reasons why Obama came to these decisions, and Schiff, by the way, is critical of Obama, thinks it was a big mistake. Frankly, I think it was a huge mistake that he didn't come forth. Now, I understand why he didn't want to feel like he was tipping the scales in the elections. Perhaps what was overriding was that they all, like Hillary Clinton and all of the Democrats, had just assumed somehow that Hillary Clinton had it in the bag. The real factor, from what I think is most incriminating, is that when he tried to get the so-called Big Eight, the bipartisan group of senior congressmen and senators, he or leading, you know, the heads of the House and Senate minority and majority, McConnell was the worst. Mitch McConnell. Not only would he not cooperate, he said apparently didn't believe the intelligence, which is incredibly cynical.
And, of course, we now know Mitch McConnell seemed to have had a little agreement with Donald Trump that his wife was going to be appointed to the cabinet, which is rather striking. But I think coming back to the earlier point you made about Schiff, if I go back to that, the hearing that occurred earlier in the week with Jay Johnson, to me, the most striking part of that hearing was the questioning by Adam Schiff, where he was pressing. And I think at one point he said, did the public have a right to know? Did it have a right to know these developments as they were coming back? And he got a very unsatisfactory answer from Jay Johnson about all that. I think Johnson told him what the administration thought and what he did, but didn't really offer a very persuasive defense of all the delays in disclosure and sharing public information. That's a huge deal. And I think, frankly, if we compare what's going on in the United States on one hand with the way absolutely parallel processes have been handled in France and Germany on the other, you see the French came forward immediately when they had information about hacking and active measures. They disclosed it. They went. Talked about it at great length, disclosing the analyses of their intelligence agencies more or less in real time, all the way up until the presidential election. I think you see it had quite an effect there. And I think we've seen the same position adopted by the German government, whereas in the United States there's been an obsession with maintaining confidentiality of sources and methods, and that has been allowed to override the public interest in knowing what's happened, and I think very much to the disadvantage of the American people.
So, Scott Horton, let's turn to what might be happening here, because the White House is lawyering up, and they clearly seem to be worried. Pence has got a lawyer, along with Trump. Trump's lawyer, of course, is this odious man, Jay Sekulow, who's represented the religious right. He's been their leading lawyer for the longest time. What I'm told is that General Flynn has, a while back, in fact, agreed to cooperate with the FBI. He's, in fact, spilled the beans and providing them with an enormous amount of information about who is up and down the chain in terms of the food chain, in terms of this Russian collusion, and that he, in effect, has given Mueller a roadmap, and Mueller's hit the ground running, and he's quite a long way down the track. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, certainly we've heard that speculation out there. And in fact, in particular from Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who is a former federal prosecutor, former U.S. attorney in Rhode Island, and who, because of his position on the Intelligence Committee, has access to considerably more information about this than you or I do directly. He thinks that. So it strikes me simply based on his analysis as plausible. It seems to me certain. This is a case in which it's hard for me to see how Flynn's lawyer, who, by the way, held out the prospect of him being a cooperating witness early on, that should be noted. It's hard for me to see how he would not strive to have such a relationship and pursue it early on, because the FBI basically they have Flynn in a trap already with the false statements he made in an FBI interview, and that's pretty ironclad. They could nail him on that already. They've also got the false statements he made about his visits to Russia, about his receiving funds from Russian sources, from a Turkish government-related source, and so forth. So we have a large number of violations here, which could be prosecuted, or they could be treated in a more lenient fashion that might involve no or very little jail time and repayment of sums. And it would be normal for prosecutors to make their call on how aggressively to proceed or whether to drop things based on whether they believe a witness is being completely honest, candid, and cooperating with them. So I would think it would be very much in Flynn's interest to be cooperating. And that may explain why Donald Trump is so obsessive and so concerned about Flynn and wanting the investigation into Flynn stopped.
Well, I find this whole situation so bizarre. I get lots of angry mail from American leftists talking about Putin bashing. And they basically parrot the Russian line, which is, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? And, of course, they refuse to believe the intelligence services, that 16 or 17 that have come to consensus. But on the other hand, they apparently believe this young woman, NSA contractor, Reality, whatever her name was, Reality being her first name, she leaked a whole bunch of NSA stuff to The Intercept. And The Intercept, by the way, has always been skeptical about the Russian involvement too. So they believe The Intercept, and what those documents say is even more alarming, that the Russian hack was much deeper than we thought, and it got into election systems. So what I can understand people like Mitch McConnell and these disgusting partisan Republicans who used to be cold warriors and red baiters who now are covering up for Putin. But I don't understand why these American leftists are so clinging to the absurdity. I mean, the fact that they somehow think maybe Putin's a socialist or something, I mean, they don't realize that he is a right-wing religious nationalist who makes, the evangelicals over on our side look, tame.
Well, I would give them. Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, Putin certainly isn't a socialist, and I think you more accurately describe his political leanings. He believes in ethno-nationalism, and with a special role for the Russian Orthodox Church as well. So that would certainly not put him on the left side of the political spectrum by any stretch of the imagination. I think a number of my friends at the Nation magazine, for instance, they're very concerned about the neocons and the neocons' pursuit of war and conflict with Russia. They instinctively react against efforts to bash Russia for that reason. I can understand that hesitation, but in this case, it's foolish. And I would say, frankly, you can exclude reading the reports of the U.S. intelligence community. Just look at what Putin himself says in television interviews he's given in Russia. And, of course, just in the last 2 weeks, he did one of his extended You Can Call Vladimir shows in which the issue of America and all the allegations surrounding his support of Trump came up. And, he puts out a sort of ritual denial, and he also does it with sort of a wink and a nod that tells you, yeah, he's very proud of the achievements of the Russian intelligence services and all this. In fact, there's now three or four times he's made statements to that effect. So, no, he's actually not denying that there's been a major program, and he seems very pleased at what this program has accomplished. I think just no doubt about that. But the bottom line is also that, assuming all this is true, and I think it is true, I think the assessments of the U.S. intelligence community are, if anything, very, very cautious and certainly accurate in the broad sweep. They're also backed by assessments of many of our allies, including the Brits, the French, the Germans, and others who have experienced the same sorts of programs going on in their countries. To deal with this problem, there's really no need to invest in nuclear warheads and military shows of might. The only thing you have to do, I think, is just what the French and the Germans did. That is, be sure that the people know that this program is going on and what the Russians are trying to accomplish by it, so that it does not in any way undermine the democratic process.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here this morning.
Great to be with you. Good luck.
Thank you, Scott. Good luck to us all. And again, I mean, speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of our background briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Malcolm Nance, a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who's been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq, Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Malcolm Nance.
Well, thank you, Ian. It's glad to be here.
Thank you, Malcolm. And what did you make of this extraordinarily exhaustive and thorough article that appeared this few days ago from the Washington Post, Obama's Secret Struggle to Punish Russia for Putin's Election Assault? Obviously, Donald Trump is now using that article, saying, blaming Barack Obama for the Russian hack. But of course, in doing so, at least he's acknowledging that it took place. So I suppose we can consider that some progress. But in general, what was your take on this revelation by the Washington Post?
Well, I thought it was an extraordinary piece of old school journalism. I mean, this is the kind of journalism where they went in, they had lots of sources, multiple sources, and they got into the real nitty gritty of what was going on during the 6 months prior to, the inauguration and the 3 months prior to the election, and tells a compelling story of how the administration, the Obama administration, was not only trying to manage this Russian hacking, but to be quite honest, they were trying to be extremely fair to the nation. And I, you know, although Donald Trump did make that hack, now suddenly acknowledging what he only a week ago called a massive hoax. But now, you know, by tomorrow, I'm sure that will completely change. But the Obama administration was trying not to look political, trying not to monkey wrench with the wheels of democracy. And it's very important that story be told, because there were things going on. The Obama administration was taking great action, but at the same time, it had to balance out, again, you know, the protection of the election itself and the impartiality of one administration over another. And some people can say that that was bad, but it just goes to show, you know, Barack Obama lives up to his title, No Drama Obama. And, you know, he was being Lincoln-esque. He didn't want to do anything to upset one side or the other. But an extraordinary piece of journalism, that's for sure.
But what I was struck by, Malcolm, was that this very dramatic scene, it's almost like a movie, where early last August an envelope with, you know, the most highly classified secrets inside of it arrived at the White House. It was sent by couriers from the CIA. It was an eyes-only package for the president himself, and it was only shared by Barack Obama and three senior aides. It wasn't a part of the president's daily briefing. So this was the most secretive piece of intelligence that the U.S. It's up there in that kind of rarefied atmosphere. And what it contained, apparently, is a revelation, which I find extraordinary, that it's now public in effect, that the CIA had somebody inside Putin's office, his inner circle, providing them with intelligence. And this intelligence indicated that Putin himself was hands-on directing the entire operation. Not only did he authorize the active measures campaign to disrupt the American election, but he also oversaw it.
Right. Well, you know, it may be a little more nebulous than all of that, but it was an extraordinary part of the article because, you know, the close hold handling that goes into these extremely high sensitivity and highly classified, which are in these documents are in sub, you know, special what we call a special activity program within a special activity program within a special activity program. And, you know, when they say this document's eyes only, it means literally that you can only read it. You are not allowed to open your mouth about it. You can't read it out loud. You look at it, you read it, it gets handed back to the courier. The courier puts it in a locked case and drives it straight back to the vault at the CIA. And those documents are up there with real names of agents, clearly identifiable sources within, you know, the highest levels of our enemies. And of course, the types of documents and activities that the president himself, and like you said, two or three people are the only people in the U.S. government that are briefed on this. Now, it's not necessarily that this was a CIA source. I've been saying this for about 10 months now, that there are other governments who do have sources in places the United States government cannot necessarily get to. And we often have relationships with those, as you saw with the incident that occurred with the Russian foreign minister about an Israeli source working against ISIS. Oftentimes we have these bilateral relationships where we provide technical support, material support, even intelligence support in the field, but another smaller country which suddenly stumbles upon some gold, you know, intelligence gold, hires and recruits an asset or has the right type of electronics collection capability. And we allow them to handle it, but they pass the information on to us. So it's, you know, but no matter what, whatever it was and whoever the source was, they had what I would call crown jewels intelligence. This is just the most secretive information in the world, which is decision-making processes within a secret program within the Kremlin. And, you know, that's not to be sold short by any measure. But if that's true, if that information is actually true, and it either somebody out there decided that it was more important to get this story out than to keep the existence of that asset in place. Maybe that asset's already been burned. Maybe he's been found. I've predicted that, you know, Putin might start killing staff this week. We've already seen Russians who were associated with the Christopher Steele memo be assassinated. So they're going to want to find out where that information came from once it got into the Post.
I've wondered about that, Malcolm, is that, you know, when you've got we just explained how incredibly secretive this information was, that the U.S. had a source inside Putin's own office. But the fact that it's now in the Washington Post would indicate that somebody inside the intelligence community blew one of their crown jewels. Earlier, there was something that came out too that was pretty shocking, and that is about the meetings the Russian the bank and the guy, a couple of those FSB guys that were being watched by the U.S. Apparently, the FBI managed to put some microphones inside these binders that these Russians working undercover who were trying to recruit Carter Page and were making fun of Carter Page.
Right.
And they basically have the transcripts of the Russian ambassador Kislyev's reporting back to Moscow Center saying, you know, this guy's a greedy jerk. And then he couldn't believe what the president's son-in-law said to him in a meeting, wanting to have a secret back channel between Trump and the Russians. So somebody also decided that was information was so important that they would basically blow the secret that the U.S. was monitoring the Russian ambassador's traffic back to Moscow.
Well, again, we're not quite sure that that information came from U.S. intelligence collection. It could have come from a third party, or it could have been shared with a third party and come from U.S. intelligence. And that's why you have to be careful about that, because, you know, if the Estonians, for example, may have been the primary collectors on that information, and they decide it's in their national interest to blow the whistle on Jared Kushner through some, you know, advanced collection platform that the United States doesn't have, but which we do get shared information from, that doesn't fall under any U.S. laws. That falls under the laws of their nation, where they may view Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's, you know, relationships with Russia as so detrimental to their national security that they type this up, drop it off. You know, I use the euphemism, you know, it drops off a truck in front of the New York Times, right? And that happens. That happens quite often. And you just don't know where that information comes from precisely. That being said, and certainly the Jared Kushner conversation with Kislyak about the secure communications back channel, that did not come from a U.S. intelligence report. That came from a document which was typed up and handed to, I believe, the New York Times or the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. So the Russians themselves could have released that information as a lever against Jared Kushner to technically make Jared Kushner do whatever they want, so long as they are not going to reveal any more information. You know, so you often have to take these not with a grain of salt, but certainly have to be aware that some of these sources and sourcing may absolutely not be indigenous to the United States, but in fact could be from a nation with their own axe to grind, or with their own political agenda, or looking out for the salvation of their own country because they view Donald Trump or Jared Kushner or Michael Flynn and the Russians as a danger to their nation.
Well, you mentioned the Christopher Steele dossier, and certainly a number of high-ranking Russian former senior FSB and SVR spies were murdered. One, I think, on Christmas Day in the backseat of his car. We also know that Putin's chief of staff, Ivanov, who was a former KGB general, very much senior to Putin, and I think too many people in the West think Putin is so extraordinarily clever, but he was a small fry in the KGB and not a particularly talented one. He's kind of a wannabe, but Ivanov was a very, very smart guy that is, you know, I mean, let's face it, Putin was stuck in East Germany. The talented Russian spies were sent to London and Washington. But nevertheless, you know, Ivanov apparently warned Putin that this attack on the U.S. election was an incredibly stupid idea, and it would have tremendous blowback. But I spoke recently with a journalist who had a piece in the Wall Street Journal making the case that the Steele dossier is in fact an FSB example of disinformation, an active measure.
Oh.
I don't buy that, but do you buy it?
No. if that's an active measure, and
was that? Sorry, you dropped out. What was that?
I said that I don't believe it's an active measure, and right. I've noticed a trend in some media outlets, and certainly some more of the insane type of bloggers, who everything now is a Russian disinformation operation. The Steele memorandum was put together by the former head of MI6's Russia branch, Christopher Steele. And he had really good sources. And, you know, in our community, the way that you validate those sources, it's certainly like this. His document was what we call rumor intelligence, right? People who had access, who were one or two people removed, but the information could be double-checked. The Moscow themselves have been validating these rumors by killing the sources that were associated with them. You know, Igor Sechin, the former chief of staff head of Rosneft. His former chief of staff was a KGB general who is believed to have been the source of the, you know, the memo that said there was a 4% commission or $19 billion if the Exxon Russia deal goes through. He woke up with two bullets in the back of his head one day. So, you know, these coincidences, as you know, I have this thing I call Nance's Law, which is coincidence takes a lot of planning. These things are just happening all over the place. You cannot have 4 and 5 diplomats in a 2-month period who may have been sources to that memorandum all suddenly have heart attacks. Russia has a special counterintelligence term for this. It's called SMERSH. And for those people who've ever watched James Bond, it was an old acronym from the Stalin period, which meant death to spies. And when they believe they have a counterintelligence leak, they kill you. Bring you back to, FSB headquarters, which is the KGB's headquarters. Right. Nothing's changed except the letters. And they will put you on trial and throw you into an oven, into a furnace alive. So, these activities, although Putin was a low level KGB guy, he is like most of us who are in the intelligence community. You never get away from it. But you have to understand Putin's job at that time was to run human intelligence officers, East Germans, to steal Western computer technology. And he seems to have advanced with computer technology's growth and realized that, you know, the West openness is their greatest weakness when it comes to carrying out compromising information or blackmail. And he just decided that he could get away with this. And his view of American democracy was the Americans won't do anything about it. Obama tried to do something about it, but too little too late. And Trump is not going to do anything about it. So Putin wins.
Well, I think that's the most incriminating thing about Trump is that not only he's denied this all along, except now that he's blaming it on Obama, that's a backhanded way of acknowledging that the Russians did it. But as Comey pointed out in his testimony, you know, they're going to come at us again. And what are the Republicans doing? What is Trump doing about it? Nothing.
You know,
I mean, these patriots, exactly. You know, that are about to celebrate the 4th of July by throwing millions of their fellow Americans into, a situation where they lose their health care coverage and get sick and perhaps die. They're celebrating that as their 4th of July patriotic gesture. I mean, these guys have got to be called out. I don't understand why the Democrats can't make a case against these McConnells and these apologists for Putin, the chief of, among them being Donald Trump.
I think that they're waiting for, you know, as I often say, people in the intelligence community, like John Brennan said in his testimony, I don't do evidence, I do intelligence. Intelligence turns into evidence when it's in the hands of the Justice Department. And now you have the Mueller investigation being carried out, and that intelligence is being turned into evidence. At some point, there will be a breaking point, because even the open source things we know about Donald Trump, his past, his financial dealings, Jared Kushner, all of this is going to come to a head, and there will be a time of reckoning when you will have to choose the nation over the party. And should they continue to choose party over the nation, Well, they may be saddled with people who were actively or inadvertently conducting espionage for Russia. That was one of the allegations in the Steele's memo, who may have actually been actively involved in, you know, engineering the result of an election for the first time in U.S. history with the help of a foreign intelligence agency. These are treasonous things that no one will want to be associated with, even if a fraction of what we know already gets validated by the Mueller investigation. And they had better I think what they're trying to do now is they're just getting these crazy agenda items like destroying healthcare, disenfranchising large parts of the American public so that they can satisfy their base. But, you know, the Russians understand all this, and they view American democracy as illegitimate. And they have worked with these people, with right-wing extremists, who they fund in some cases, like the California separatists and the neo-Nazis. And they use this to discredit the viability of American democracy. And, you know, that was a communist ideology that came out after communism, and now it's about oligarchies and autocracies leading the world, and Putin wants to be the leader of that movement. And now he has a partner in Donald Trump.
Well, Malcolm Lance, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Malcolm. And again, I've been speaking with Malcolm Lance, a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who's been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and Sub-Saharan Africa. His latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Elections. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Erwin. And what do you make of the speculation from the Associated Press and CNN and these rumors that are swirling, and they've gone viral on the internet, that Justice Anthony Kennedy is considering retiring?
Well, we have no idea if this is just speculation feeding on itself or if there's some basis for the speculation. The rumors have been there for a while that Justice Kennedy is thinking of retiring, maybe at the end of this term, perhaps at the end of next term. He'll turn 81 on July 23rd. But to this point, he's not confirming or denying anything.
So what is this speculation then about the clerks being called to an earlier retirement, or not a retirement party, but some kind of reunion that was supposed to take place last year, but it's been moved forward? Is that what's fueling the speculation?
Some of what's fueling the speculation is the timing of the clerks' reunion. But clerks often have reunion with their justices, and the timing is a product of so many things. So maybe this is an indication that he's going to be stepping down very soon. Maybe it's just coincidence. No one knows at this point.
And your colleague at UC Irvine, Leah Littman, she clerked for Justice Kennedy. Has she been told anything, do you think?
I haven't spoken with Leah about this, and I doubt that he's confided in his former clerks. My guess is at this point only Justice Kennedy and his family know whether he's planning on stepping down.
And there's always been a link made to the appointment of Gorsuch. There's a suggestion that this is the Republican strategy. You get Gorsuch on the court. Since he clerked for Kennedy, then he will therefore be able to give Kennedy the exit that he apparently wants, or at least people are speculating he'd want it for some time. He'd like to retire. And Gorsuch has sort of paved the way, and it's presumably influencing him somehow behind the scenes. Do you buy that?
I don't buy it at all. I think Anthony Kennedy has to decide about his health, his stamina, how he wants to spend the remaining years of his life. He knows that he's right now the most pivotal person on the Supreme Court. He has to realize that President Trump appointing a conservative will risk undoing much of what he's accomplished in his 30 years on the court. And only he can balance those considerations. I doubt Neil Gorsuch being on the court is going to be a big factor one way or the other.
But elaborate further, if you will. The assumption's always been that while he's a swing vote and often considered a moderate, he's also the author of Citizens United, perhaps one of the most consequential rulings of the Supreme Court, certainly in recent history, which is a very, obviously had extremely conservative ramifications, if you will. So what's the sense that you have that he has a legacy that is not in line with the conservatives?
Well, there's no doubt that Justice Kennedy votes with the conservatives more than does with the liberals. Citizens United being an example where he wrote the opinion joined by the most conservative justice on the court. On the other hand, every Supreme Court opinion in history expanding rights for gays and lesbians was written by Anthony Kennedy. That includes the two decisions that found a right to marriage equality for gays and lesbians. Last year, Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion for the court upholding affirmative action. Justice Kennedy was the key fifth vote to reaffirm Roe v. Wade. Just last year, is a key fifth vote to strike down a Texas law imposing restrictions on abortion. Justice Kennedy has written the opinions limiting some of the applications of the death penalty, like that the death penalty can't be used for crimes committed by juveniles or for the crime of child rape. It is the Anthony Kennedy Court, and it's been at least since Sandra Day O'Connor left the bench in 2006.
Now, I must say, Owen, that it feels to me like what's going on here with all this feverish speculation, and it's exploding all over social media and the internet, it's almost like, you know, hello, don't you realize that elections have consequences? I mean, the fact that Donald Trump has already had one Supreme Court appointee, obviously Mitch McConnell allowed that by denying Obama Justice Garland. And that in itself is a subject for a lot of conversation. But what's your sense then of why it is all of a sudden people are in a panic?
The longest term consequence of any presidential election was who the president puts on the Supreme Court and on the lower federal courts. Neil Gorsuch is 49 years old. If he remains on the Supreme Court until he's 90, the age with Justice John Paul Stevens retired, he'll be a justice for the next 41 years. There's no doubt that Donald Trump replacing Anthony Kennedy with a Gorsuch or a Scalia will move the court much further to the right. Why is there so much speculation now about Justice Kennedy retiring? Tomorrow is the last day of this term. All the remaining opinions will come down. And if Justice Kennedy is going to step down, it will likely be very soon after tomorrow.
So do you think a part of it then is this concern that Roe v. Wade could be struck down?
I have no doubt that if Anthony Kennedy is replaced by a Trump nominee, there will be five votes to overrule Roe v. Wade. I think there are four on the current court. That would be five. There will be five votes to eliminate all forms of affirmative action. People should have realized this a long time ago, but it certainly becomes more salient in thinking about Donald Trump replacing Anthony Kennedy.
Well, Owen Jamieruski, I appreciate you joining us here, and we are speculating, but we'll stay tuned, and I hope to talk to you again.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century. And his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. And he frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. And joining us now is Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Siegel.
Thanks, Ian.
And in spite of the title of your book, there's no question, Eric, that if Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy retires, as the rumors and speculation swirling now indicate, it will have extraordinary consequences, will it not?
Yes, this would be by far and away the most important retirement since Justice Powell retired in the mid-1980s, which led to the Judge Bork and then Judge Ginsburg and then eventually Justice Ginsburg's seat. And it would make Justice Roberts the swing vote. And I think I speak for all liberals, progressives, that is a very, very scary thought.
Well, I've always thought the definitions, though, about who's a liberal and who's a conservative have somewhat missed the point, because you really, the court has moved so far to the right over the last few decades that you can barely call a lot of the people on that are called liberals. Some of them are centrists. There's no real liberals in the tradition of Thurgood Marshall and William O. Douglas.
I think it's a little more complicated than that, Ian, to be honest. A friend of mine, Judge Posner, talks about how when the country moves to the right, or in the 60s to the left, the court moves with it. So it is true that Kagan and Sotomayor and Breyer are not as liberal as Marshall and Brennan, but it's also true that the country today is nowhere near as liberal as the country was during their times. So the real question is, I think, in my opinion, is are Kagan and Sotomayor and Breyer, you know, to the left, what Marshall and Brennan were to the left back then? I think the answer to that question is probably yes. But the court, because of Justice Kennedy, has moved to the right significantly because, except for a few areas, Justice Kennedy is a conservative, and he has been the swing vote now for a very long time.
Well, Eric, you can thank Rupert Murdoch for the fact that the country moved to the right. You know, he.
I agree with that.
No, seriously, he befriended the Reagan administration. He got them to get rid of the fairness doctrine that the FCC had had for decades, that restricted extreme political speech, because if you owned a network, if you're a media mogul like Murdoch, and you wanted to use your network as a private soapbox to propagate your own ideas, you would have to offer equal and opposite time to the opposite point of view. And that had the effect of restraining extreme political speech in the American political dialogue. And as you know, it's gotten incredibly toxic, and Fox has led the way in creating these political tribes. And now apparently, you know, the old expression that the two things you don't talk about in this country, religion and politics. Well, apparently politics are now a deciding factor in whether this person is a member of your tribe or not.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I would add one aspect to it. That fairness doctrine was on a collision course with the Supreme Court anyway. I think it would have eventually been overturned. I'm not saying it should be. I'm just saying it would have been. But I agree. I mean, it's amazing to me. I've lived long enough where I have friends now who say things like, I hope my child doesn't marry a Republican or doesn't marry a Democrat, whatever. It's really a terrible state we're in. Terrible.
But still, even if there is this inevitable backlash, if you have this incredibly regressive, reactionary Supreme Court, I mean, won't you, for example, with Roe v. Wade, which is pretty much the sort of litmus test for better or for worse in American society, wouldn't you have a situation where it'd get kicked back to the states, and then you'd have a bunch of young women in the red states of this country having to go to the Greyhound bus station to get a bus to drive hundreds of miles to a blue state, and then, of course, at the bus station, you would have Christian vigilantes wandering around checking people's papers to see whether the young woman has parental consent?
So I don't, first of all, I am pro-choice all the way down. I work for Planned, I have volunteered for Planned Parenthood, and I met my wife through Planned Parenthood. I want to get that on the table. I don't see it as clearly as that, Ian. I have to be, I'm going to disappoint you now a little bit probably, but the fact of the matter is today in red states, it is very, very hard for women to get abortions. Unless you're next to a city, big city, in a red state, it is virtually impossible. In my region of the country, in Alabama and Mississippi, there's about one clinic per state, and no doctor openly admits to performing abortions in those states because they will be subject to violence if they do. That's also true in Montana and other places like that. So middle-class women will always get abortions and relatively safe ones. Poor women would be in deep trouble in the world you're describing, but they're in deep trouble today. Having said all that, I don't know if Roe is going to be overturned, even with the most repressive court. I think Justice Roberts might balk at that. I'm not positive about that, obviously. But I will say this. Conservatives and evangelicals still raise money off of Roe. Donald Trump, I think, was elected in great part because of the reaction to Obergefell. 20% of the people said the Supreme Court was their biggest issue, and all of them voted for Trump, basically.
But just to let the audience know.
Same-sex marriage.
Same-sex marriage. Obergefell's same-sex marriage. Go ahead.
So what would happen? Let's look at that. So from a perspective of someone on the left like me, Roe versus Wade was an unmitigated disaster for every issue I care about except abortion. Unmitigated disaster. And how successful was it for abortion? I don't know the answer to that. I know in 1971, middle-class and rich women got safe abortions and poor women didn't. And I know in 2017, the same thing is more or less true, unless you live in New York City or Los Angeles or Detroit. So returning the issue of Roe to the states, in my opinion, for every issue that's not abortion, would help the left tremendously. Abortion is a huge issue for me, as I said. But it's not been a net victory for the left. You think about Ronald Reagan and the New Right and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And now, for goodness, I'm sorry I'm ranting, but I can't help it. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson's personal lawyer is now the lawyer for the president. He is a terrible person, this lawyer for the president, Jay Sekulow. You'd never have heard of Jay Sekulow if it wasn't for abortion. So I don't know. I'm more conflicted about this from the Supreme Court perspective than I think you are. Yeah.
Well, just in closing, Eric Segal, this strikes me as being somewhat ironic and a belated recognition on the part of people who either didn't vote or perhaps voted for a third party in this election. And nobody's defending Hillary Clinton's appalling campaign, but still, elections have consequences.
I agree. And what the American people really should, if I could say one thing to non-lawyers and non-law professors out there, what I would say is it is absolutely outrageous that any, if it was Hillary or Trump, it wouldn't matter. The Supreme, if two justices retire in the next 3 years, which I think is likely, that court is going to last for generations, for 30, 40 years. I mean, really, 25 to 40 years. The whole idea of life tenure for these justices is insane, and we're the only country in the world that has it. So, I mean, elections have consequences, and they should have consequences for the next 4 years, 5 years, but not for 30 years. But when it comes to the Supreme Court, elections have consequences for 30 years. That's no way to run a country and no way to run a court.
Well, Eric Segal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Segal, a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.